say, and you're haunted by the swords they raise. Like a rabid dog we've seen before, they refuse to hear the world pounding, pounding down their door.
We don't want your war.
Let's all yell a little louder now.
We don't want your war.
All stand together tall.
We don't want your war.
You keep telling us, you keep telling us we do. The king has no clothes, so he leads by fear. We must challenge all the lies we hear. The devil's bombs has an oily smell, frames a legacy with infamy. He burns it into hell.
We don't want your war,
so yell a little louder now.
We don't want your war.
All stand together tall.
We don't want your war.
But you keep telling us, you keep telling us we do. Try to turn us into lemmings with their magic on TV. The scoop, but we're no closer to the truth. If we raise our flag on a million graves, will we all be proud, or will we be ashamed of our leadership? Greedy and arrogant, and we'll all be judged by the choices that we made.
We don't want your war.
Telling us we do.
We don't want your war.
Don't stand together, yeah.
We don't want your war.
All stand together tall.
We don't want your war.
So stop telling us, stop telling us we do.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. John Hopkins surgeon Marty Markery provides an insider's look at the dangers of staying in the hospital. He argues that patients are endangered by errors, overtreatment, and closed-door culture that protects medical practitioners first.
And quite frankly, we need fresh ideas in healthcare. You know, we've been talking about the same stuff for years. We need some new ideas.
So this field of quality and safety in healthcare is a relatively young field, if you will. And you've talked about the need for patients and consumers to get actively involved. In fact, you referenced the fact that doctors can't do it, regulators can't do it, politicians can't do it, but that patients have to do it. Talk a little bit more, if you will, about the role that patients need to have. Because today, I'm struck with the fact that if I go Google something on the internet, a certain disease or treatment, I will get hundreds, perhaps thousands of different sites to go to. And one thing I keep hearing from patients is they have difficulty navigating that. How do they know what the high quality data that's out there exists? You referenced a couple, but if we're going to ask patients and consumers to play an active role and help us move forward and change this system, how do they navigate that? What's their role within that?
That's a great question. And, you know, there's probably, even with all these great websites out there, Consumer Reports, Hospital Safety Score, Hospital Compare, ZocDoc to look at patient satisfaction scores, even with all these new websites that are being populated with more and more information every year, nothing substitutes for a great conversation between you and a doctor or you and a nurse in the doctor's office. There's something to be said for the patient that does the research on Google, which, by the way, is 92% accurate for health information. We've done that research at Johns Hopkins. People type in their operation, their condition, their medication. What they're looking at in the first hit is 92% right on. And there's something to be said for people who do that, bring that into the doctor's office and have that conversation. What I often tell people is, if you're going to have something major, like an operation, or you're going to start taking a medication every day for the first time in your life, or you don't know what you have wrong with you and the doctor can't figure it out, get a second opinion. Get a second opinion. Those are times when we've got to remember that the stats show 30% of second opinions are different from the first opinion. We are human beings. Even in my own area of expertise, I will run things by a partner or an expert somewhere else in the country. Somebody has seen a different variation or a different presentation. It is no substitute, I think, for good conversations with doctors. You know, doctors are as frustrated with the broken healthcare system as the patients are. And I think when we see ourselves in the same boat, I think we have a certain appreciation. I tell the medical students, treat every patient like it's your own mother or father. And I think that's a good guiding principle that was taught to me.
So just to follow up on that, you throughout the book, you talk about the importance of teamwork, and you just referenced it now. But I'm struck with the need for teamwork, if you will, as we move forward in healthcare reform, as well as if we start to tackle some of the issues you've identified. Arnie Milstein, who's at Stanford, who you know, talks about the fact that we have many moving parts, many players in healthcare, if you will, where we have many people who are responsible, but little accountability overall. So how would you see, first of all, two questions. One, what's the role of teamwork in the care that we deliver and the importance of that? And what's the role of the patient within that? And how can we move forward with all the different groups, physicians, insurers, regulators, patients, to try and resolve some of these issues?
You know, everybody seems to recognize that teamwork is a critical part of delivering safe and high-quality care. Yet we've never even measured it for the longest time. It's almost as if in a factory, you know, there's one part of the assembly line that is so shoddy, it's just off and on, unreliable, and it hurts the entire process, and yet no one really looks into it. There's now a survey that Brian Sexton created that measures the quality of the teamwork. It asks everyday providers, would you go here for your own care? Do you feel comfortable speaking up? Do you feel that you're part of a team, or do you feel that your concerns are not really being heard? And it turns out that these results now are being followed and tracked. They're just not available to the public. The government even issues the survey on its website. It makes it available for a free download for hospitals. And it collects a lot of the information, yet there's no real accountability around that. That's one simple thing we can do differently. But oftentimes when I talk to docs and nurses, they will say that when the teamwork is good here, everybody is happy. When the nurse turnover rates are low, that is, few nurses are quitting and getting hired at other institutions, when the turnover rate is low, they just feel that they own the care better. It's a better place to work. You know, when I had my near miss, if you will, I describe in the book a time when I harmed a patient from a mistake I had made. I describe a time when I almost operated on the wrong side.
And the nurse spoke up.
And the nurse spoke up. Yeah. And that's what saved the patient having a wrong side procedure. I remember the day. It was crazy busy. I was shuttling from the ICU to deal with a quick emergency. Came back to the operating room. My team had sort of prepped the patient, and they prepped the wrong side. It was a minor procedure, but it would have had catastrophic consequences for me and for the patient. And it's just one of these things where you realize it's a team sport. And more we're hearing the nurses say, you know, if we can have more teamwork, less disruptive behavior. And we've got a study now, the Archives of Surgery reports, 90% of nurses and 40% of doctors have witnessed disruptive behavior in the last 3 months. And we can do a lot, I think, to improve the teamwork in a lot of hospitals. And a lot of it starts with the peer respected leaders.
So the work that you did, Brian Sexton, Peter Pronovost, and others, really talk about the issues of culture, the importance and the importance of teamwork. And I'm struck by the many examples that you've given and I've heard through the years of the importance of the members of the team, perhaps not the physician or the surgeon, speaking up. And in fact, you describe one in your book. What has to happen in order for that to become more common in the culture, especially in procedure areas where perhaps, you know, we equate the operating room to what happens flying a plane and the need that where aviation went through some of these things really decades ago and what they took away. From your perspective, how does that teamwork really get enhanced moving forward? And what starts it? Who has to start it?
You know, it's one of those cultural traits that changes over time, but we need it to change a lot faster. Sometimes I think of the hierarchy of medicine sort of like the hierarchy in the military. You know, we have these sort of rules and procedures. We have these ways of doing things. We have these unwritten standards that we never go above our superior's head for anything. You know, I think we can be more honest and open about the problems in healthcare, and we can redesign the way we talk in the operating room, in the healthcare setting, in the clinics, in the hospital. When we developed the checklist for the operating room, this is after Peter Pronovost worked in the ICU and said, here, we're going to have a daily goal sheet.
And you and Atul Gawande.
Gawande later popularized he's led the World Health Organization group. We had presented our experience to the group, and it became much bigger than we ever anticipated. But the number one priority that we made in the checklist was making the first item, going over the names and the members of the team, going over their roles. And it's just a simple introduction. And when Gawande led our committee at the World Health Organization, he was particular that that be the number one item as well. We all saw the value in making introductions, just a simple statement of your name and what your role you have in the team, to be a critical part, not only just to be friendly. I mean, let's face it, that's nice, but that wasn't the goal. It was to empower people to speak up. If at your workplace you have a conference room and you're sitting around for a meeting and you have to say something in the beginning or present something or speak up for any reason, it's easier to speak up again. It's almost as if the first time you speak up and say anything, you're activated. And that's what we try to do, is activate every member of the team
So the team members are activated. What about the patient? Do we want the patient to speak up as well?
Yeah,
are there family members?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's amazing the amount of information patient family members add to our understanding of the patient's condition. And by and large, if you can join a family member when they see their doctor, go with them. And this new program called Open Notes that allows patients to instantly see their doctor's note when they go to see a doctor for a visit has been tremendously successful, not because it's going to fix healthcare. I mean, let's face it, innovation like that is not going to solve our healthcare crisis or cost problem. But there's this disproportionate amount of enthusiasm for it, in part because it represents the profession of medicine bridging that divide and saying, hey, you're a part of this. And it's the doctor sharing with the patient in an open and honest way, I want you to see what our plan is. I want you to see what I wrote down. Even add a line to it, if you like. Say at the bottom, I agree, or there's a mistake, or I misspoke, or this is BS. I don't think this represents me. And that'll be part of the patient's record. You know, one time I had a patient who I was seeing, and she was asking about abdominal pain, and she asked me a question that was a little bizarre, something about, does a certain type of Ben & Jerry's ice cream over another type cause this kind of pain? I told her, no, it doesn't. It's unrelated. And then she, at the end, had this sort of suspicion, and it turns out she was worried that I wrote in the chart that she's a psycho or she's crazy or something. And I said, no, here it is. And when she saw the note, the bond of trust was almost instantly restored.
So we have a couple minutes left and just two last questions. So first of all, we've talked about the role of leaders and clinicians, but what role do boards of trustees of hospitals in particular have? I know there's been a movement around getting them involved. I wonder if you could just spend a minute or so talking about that.
Well, first of all, I was very disappointed that I saw the Department of HHS change this new rule that a physician should be on a hospital board. There was this attempt to make one physician, at least to have one physician on a board of a hospital. And they overturned this intended rule at the last minute. And it was a great disappointment, I think, to a lot of doctors. It just doesn't make sense to a lot of patients the same. But the broader subject of a hospital board's mission, you know, when the hospital boards and the good ones are focused on the hospital's outcomes, when the boards are in looking at the performance with metrics, when they've got a dashboard, hospitals do very well and the boards are doing a great service. When they are looking at it like a pure business and it's just the bottom line, then that's when the culture becomes very bad.
So we've just got a minute or so left. So just to wrap up, this book has had a tremendous impact. You've gotten a lot of press on it. Are you going to keep operating? Are you going to go on the lecture circuit, keep teaching? What are your plans moving forward?
Well, I love being a doctor. There's no better job in the world than to come out after surgery and say, your mom's going to be fine, and here's what we did. But I also love talking about this subject because I feel like from my position at Hopkins, being open and honest about this problem, other people have come and spoken up about it. And I think I'm going to continue to do some speaking at different meetings and conferences and still operate about 3 days a week.
That sounds great. And potentially write another book?
Hopefully.
That's great. Well, I'm Chip Davis, and for Marty Makary, the book is Unaccountable, and we appreciate you taking the time today.
Great to be with you, Chip.
Good to be with you.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Coming up next, Dr. Sonia Huberminski on the myths of happiness. She talks with Tom Hartman.
For tonight's Conversations with Great Minds, I'm joined by Dr. Sonia Huberminski. She's a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, received her AB from Harvard University and her PhD in social personality psychology from Stanford University. Her work and research on happiness has been honored with a John Templeton Foundation grant, Science of Generosity grant, Templeton Positive Psychology Prize, and $1 million grant from the National Institute of Mental Health. She's also the author of the critically acclaimed book, The Myths of Happiness. Dr. Huberminski joins us now from our Los Angeles studio. Dr. Huberminski, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Let's start out with just the simple stuff. What is your definition of happiness?
Well, I use the definition that researchers use, which is that happiness essentially has two components. So the first component is the experience of positive emotions, joy, serenity, curiosity, affection. And the second component is the feeling, having the feeling that your life is going well, that you're progressing towards your life's goal. So you really need both of those components to be a truly happy person.
So it seems like one is positional, kind of static, and the other is an arc. It's a sense of an arc that's moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, you could say it that way. I think of it as really emotional, right? It's experiencing emotions, which does vary over time. And the other is a more of a kind of a cognitive judgment, like judgment is that your life is going well.
And you list a number of, in fact, each chapter of your book is dealing with one of the common myths of happiness. Let's go through a few of those. What do you think is probably the most pervasive myth about happiness in American society?
Well, you know, I like to think of the myths of happiness as kind of in two different categories, sort of the two primary myths. And the first one is really the idea that, you know, I'm not happy now, but I'll be happy when, you know, X, Y, and Z happen to me. When I get married, you know, when I get that promotion I've always wanted, when I have money, when I have more money. And that can be kind of divided up into smaller myths. And the problem with those beliefs or fallacies is that, you know, they are true. I mean, those things do make us happy, but they don't make us as happy for as long or as intensely as we think they will.
Abe Maslow, in his Hierarchy of Human Needs back in the 70s, talked about how there's these, you know, basic human needs, you know, homeostasis and social needs. And then as you go up this pyramid, he didn't describe this as happiness at the top, he described it as self-actualization. How does self-actualization what are your thoughts on Maslow's notion of self-actualization compared with your description of happiness?
Yeah, great question. That's the first time anyone's asked me that question. Well, you know, self-actualization is a different construct from happiness. Not much research has been done on it empirically. It's kind of like when you're truly flourishing. You know, you're at the top of the pyramid of needs. You know, you sort of have have, you're thriving, you're flourishing. It's very much related to happiness because happier people are more likely, I would speculate, are more likely to get to the top of that pyramid. And I talk about human needs quite a bit in the myths of happiness, because what I talk about is that what happens is that once we achieve one thing, we're not happy. You know, we're not content. We want the next thing. And that's fine. That's a good thing. You know, that's how we progress. That's how we make progress. But the problem with that is that we're never quite content. You know, we always want the next thing. So that's very relevant to that pyramid of needs.
In your book, in the last chapter, you talked about how you were surprised by your third pregnancy, or your third child, as I recall. And, that's one of those life things happen, and it's, you know, there's that old cliche of it. It's not what happens to us, it's how we react to what happens to us that determines our quality of life. Is that an expression of that? I mean, is that something that's reducible to that simple a notion?
You know, absolutely. I think one of the biggest themes of my book is this idea that it's how we frame, how we construe, how we perceive ourselves and the world and other people around us that perhaps matters more than what actually happens to us. And so I talk a lot about attention, kind of what do we direct our attention to? You know, William James, the philosopher, has this great quote. He says, "My experience is what I agree to attend to." Mm-hmm. And I think it's an amazing insight. It basically says that what we choose to focus on, what we choose to direct our attention to, is our experience, is our life. So we could spend our days focusing on negatives, you know, or we could spend our days focusing on sort of the good things in our life, sort of what we're grateful for. It doesn't mean that we have to deny the bad stuff, but really, you know, it's in our control, it's in our power to choose what to think about, what to direct our attention to, sort of how to perceive the world around us.
Do you think that resilience is part of the dimensionality of happiness? And does resilience lead to happiness, or is happiness the consequence of being more resilient?
Right. And it clearly is both. You know, the causal direction probably goes both ways. But resilience is very much related to happiness. So I talk about resilience a lot. The second kind of myth of happiness that I talk about is this idea that, you know, oh my God, if certain really bad things happen to me, I'm going to be forever unhappy. If I get a divorce, if I don't find a life partner, if I don't make as much money as I want to make, if I get sick. But, you know, people are remarkably resilient, and happier people are more resilient. But we can learn coping skills. We can learn to be more resilient. In fact, what I was just talking about, learning to direct your attention on the things in life that really matter, on the things that are sort of more positive, the things that you're grateful for, is one of the main strategies that resilient people use.
And you're suggesting it's learnable.
Yes, it is learnable, but it's hard. I mean, I think there's also probably kind of a trait component. Certain people do seem to be more resilient than others, but we can learn some of these coping strategies. Yes.
Well, there was a study back in, I think it was the longitudinal study done from the 50s to the 70s on children in Kauai, children of great poverty who were severely abused, and what they found was that rather than the normal kind of bell-shaped distribution of resilience, moderate resilience, and absolute lack of resilience, it became more like a V. There were actually more of these children who were highly resilient and more of them who were highly not resilient, highly fragile, and the kind of middle ground vanished. To what extent does our childhood affect our adulthood, and how can we respond to that in ways that make us more resilient if our childhood left us less resilient?
Was having trouble, what a sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he? Where could that man be? We looked around, and then we found the man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
Marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Winter for Poland and France.
Germans, go into your dance.
born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Now for something completely different.